To the Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. I am your host, Nick Agar Johnson, and joining me once again, Jam Hines. Jam, how are you doing this fine evening?
Doing great. I'm excited to talk some hoops tonight. We got a great prospect to talk about and some great topics alongside that prospect. So looking forward to it.
So let's start out where you started out with the article. So your most recent article for NoCeilingsNBA.com on Isaiah Evans, the human torch, as you called him, for the Duke Blue Devils. And I want to start with where I generally start with these, which is, especially given Evans's playing time situation, I'm curious, why did you decide to write about Isaiah Evans for this article at this time of the year?
Yeah, so it's really what you hinted at right there. So it's a combination of him, for me, at least at the preseason stuff, I had him as a lottery pick, really borderline in that top 10. I think consensus, he was at least top 20. And then for him not to really get the playing time, at least initially, and really for the most part throughout the season, see how that really affect his draft stock and to him kind of coming back and playing well. So it was just very interesting to me just seeing where he was preseason to where he is now and kind of like that roller coaster. And for him heating up at this point, I thought it was a great time to talk about him.
Yeah, it's not new for Duke to have so many top recruits that at least one of them gets squeezed out of playing time. Yeah. But certainly, I mean, in terms of, you know, from where the season started to where it appears to be now, I mean, it's not like the Duke team has certainly lived up to expectations, which were very high anyway, but it's interesting to me, and I want to draw a very specific comparison here. It's interesting to me because given how spectacular he is as a shooter, the kind of assumption would be, hey, maybe that guy gets more minutes because it's hard not to find a fit for a 6'6 shooter in a lineup. But especially over the last couple of weeks, when I've been watching Isaiah Evans' film, the player I can't get out of my mind is Jordan Hawkins. And with Jordan Hawkins, his first year at Kentucky, he came in, you know, he was not as highly recruited as Isaiah Evans was, but he was still a top 50 guy in his high school class. Comes in his first year at UConn, he averages 15 minutes, he shoots 35% from the floor, 33% from three-point range. And a lot of players in that kind of situation would lose confidence and stop shooting. And not only did Jordan Hawkins not do that, but he shot a whole lot more the next season and, you know, obviously got himself drafted in the lottery. And this year has been a lost year for Hawkins and the New Orleans Pelicans in general. So, you know, not, I'm leaning more on my last year evaluation of Hawkins' first NBA season rather than this year, which there's only so many conclusions that you can draw from this season in New Orleans. But the idea was the same of, look, whatever else his skill set might be, you bring him in, you put him on the floor for 20 minutes. He's shooting the ball every time the ball touches his hands beyond the arc. And that's what you want him to do when he's that kind of shooter. And for me with Evans is the kind of thing where, again, you know, there are questions around a lot of the rest of his game, which we'll certainly get into. But just purely in terms of, look, you plug Isaiah Evans into an NBA team's rotation tomorrow, and he's one of the better shooters, right? That's ultimately the kind of thing where it's why he was so highly touted heading into the season. It's why he has crept back into my top 60 later in the season, you know, because of that shooting that he's shown. But a lot of teams can use the kind of player that Isaiah Evans is at the absolute baseline. And then the question becomes, where can he develop from there, right? But just purely in terms of this is a guy who we know will be a high-quality shooter on the wing, I just, again, I keep going back to Jordan Hawkins, and it's a similar situation, not in terms of the shooting percentage, but in terms of, hey, I'm not playing much, I could lose confidence from that. That's not been the case for Isaiah Evans, and certainly that bodes well for transitioning to the NBA where things are much more difficult for everybody, right? If you have that baseline that Isaiah Evans has, it just makes everything else a lot easier.
Yeah, you're absolutely spot on. And I'm so glad that you brought up the Jordan Hawkins name. Like, I think that it's such a great call and is right on the nose as far as his role and his comp blend or prospect chemistry, as we were referred to as, and those ceilings. So yeah, I think with the frame, the shooting, the movement shooting, which we will get into, just a lot of, like you said, the baseline, kind of the main ingredients, if you will, on both with the strengths and the weaknesses, mainly being kind of the skinny frame, which was the concern for Hawkins, just as it is for Evans, and just kind of what he would do on that end. And we saw, even his rookie year coming in, the times that he was able to play, he did have some really good moments as a shooter and struggled defensively. And that's just kind of what it's been for him. And like you said, if he's able to get on the court from day one, it will be in that tall shooting role, that movement shooter, that floor spacing role that you can see looks exactly like Jordan Hawkins.
And, you know, as you mentioned, he was, again, much more highly recruited than Hawkins. I mean, he was the 16th best player in his high school class. Hawkins was, again, just barely top 50. But I think the concept there, you know, I was willing to buy more into Hawkins defensively than Evans. But the difference there is you can get Isaiah Evans, in, if assuming he declares, right? You can get him a lot later in the draft than 14. And so to get a similar kind of impact at, you know, 25 is, that's where you go from this is a good pick to this is a steal kind of pick.
Absolutely. And like if he does declare, we'll see what he ends up really doing. But for me personally, if I was advising him, if you're not going to be in that kind of top 20, you might as well go back to school. But if he does declare and is outside of that top 25 or so, you're absolutely right. That's going to be a steal. And whoever is coming up at that point will be running to the podium.
Yeah, I mean, it's the kind of thing where just given this year's Duke team, it's like, okay, if you come back next year, I would be stunned if next year's Duke team is anywhere near as good as this year's Duke team, right? So it's like, you know, you are asked to carry a team in a way that, you know, he didn't really get off the bench consistently until recently. That's the opposite of carrying a team, right? But you know, there are two ways that can go, right? I mean, sometimes it's the Alex Poitras, and sometimes it's Jordan Hawkins returning after a rough year one, winning a national title, being, you know, one of the best players on that national title team and going in the lottery. I could see both worlds for Isaiah Evans because Hawkins was the same deal, but he's quite dependent on the players around him. And that's the kind of thing where, you know, having NBA passers around you is something that's a pretty big upgrade for most players. Going from, you know, despite the point guard woes at Duke, I mean, Cooper Flagg, Colin Knuppel, and Tyrese Proctor are all NBA players who all have passing talents, right? So the passing upgrade for going to the NBA might not be as dramatic for Isaiah Evans as it would be for some other people. So, you know, maybe that means next year he gets more opportunity to show, okay, what can I do on ball? And then, you know, maybe he gets into that top 10 range like he was for you prior to the season. That could also go very wrong. You know, going back to the Alex Poitras example, right? He would have been a first round pick if he declared after his freshman year, and he very much was not, and only got a cup of coffee in the NBA, and that was kind of it. So because of Evans' skill set, again, the floor is quite high given his shot, but it's everything else that he would need to make a pretty significant leap forward on to be the kind of player that can be a number one or a number two for Duke next year, which presumably would be the goal if he's coming back.
Yeah, absolutely. You would hope that he's kind of in that dynamic duo with Cam Boozer, them on the perimeter, and then you know you have whoever you're going to have returning. But I would hope Darren Harris, still very, very high on him, another shooter there, tall shooter, that'll be in that lineup. So that'll be a very fun Duke team. I know it'll be a lot of attention every year as it is on Duke, but especially with Cam Boozer getting in there as well. And it could be a very good situation for him to come back to where he still has a primary, a number one or 1A, however you want to categorize it, for him to play off of that as he's doing with Cooper Flagg, but just with an extended minutes and extended role.
Yeah, going from Cooper Flagg to Cam Boozer is kind of insane, but it's recently what you expect from Duke at this point. So it's not exactly out of the realm of possibility. Let's dial in on Evans specifically. And we've talked about it a lot. And the reason we've talked about it a lot is because it's the thing to talk about, which is this guy is a shooter. And as you say, he embodies the phrase shooter shoot, which is again, it's the kind of thing where even though he's, you know, played minimal minutes, played a relatively small role, it's the kind of thing where because he's that good of a shooter, there could very easily be an NBA team who says, look, I don't care that there isn't much else that we're expecting from you in year one or year two. We can take our time with that and you'll get 10 minutes a game just as a shooter anyway.
Yeah, and I think that's such an easy role for him to come in. And I think that's why ultimately this will be a very good experience for him to experience this. He's coming in off the bench. It's a role where he is just a shooter. We need you to space the floor, to launch, be a microwave shooter, microwave scorer, and then give us effort defensively. You know, we need that from you. We know that you aren't going to be a lockdown, multi-positional type of defender, at least right now. I don't see that in the future, but, you know, still want to cover our bases, want to leave that upside there. We are no ceilings. I want to put a ceiling on them there quite yet. But that's not going to be too much expecting on the defensive end. So I think for him playing the role that he's playing right now at Duke is certainly a realistic floor for him where he can be very effective from day one.
So I think there are two things that I want to dial in on there. The first is sort of the most obvious, which is, you know, frame aside, given that he's 6'6", there's more room for him to be flexible defensively. There's a larger swath of players that you could task him with guarding than if he was 6'3", and, you know, essentially he would have to guard point guards, right? He's not a smaller shooter in terms of the height, which I think is more important for long-term projection, because however much weight he adds, it's going to be something, right? He's not going to be, like, by the time he's 28 years old, he's not going to be 6'6 and 175 pounds, right? Yeah. So given that we're sort of starting with that baseline, I've started to become more and more convinced of the impact of strength on prospects and how important it is and how much of an X factor it can be for guys. But, you know, the flip side of that is you can put on good weight unless you're getting, you know, some kind of experimental surgery that would probably not be approved for playing on an NBA floor. You're not going to get taller, right? Yeah. So, you know, barring the sort of unexpected 19, 20-year-old late stage Paul George, Giannis Antetokounmpo, whoever you want to name, growth spurt, the fact that he's 6'6 gives him a better long-term projection defensively, I think, than if he were 6'3 and stocky. You know, even with the added importance of strength, that's something that you can and should expect young players to add. And that's also where, it, you know, fall apart is not the right way of putting it, but that's where I think it's important to draw a distinction between Isaiah Evans and Jordan Hawkins, which is Jordan Hawkins is about to turn 23 years old. Isaiah Evans is still a teenager, right? There's more projection of, okay, there's going to be, you know, a couple years of growth where he's going to be putting on weight that Jordan Hawkins was kind of already at that point. And obviously, NBA strength and conditioning program is going to be much better than a college strength and conditioning program, even when we're talking about, you know, elite of the elite college teams like Duke and Connecticut. At least the NCAA has so graciously allowed these players to actually earn enough money to buy their own food. So that element of the added strength is no longer a factor. But even with that part of it, just being in an NBA strength and conditioning program is going to do wonders for Isaiah Evans in a way that, as much as it has clearly helped Jordan Hawkins, he was much closer to being done growing, at least, you know, in terms of frame, than Isaiah Evans is.
Yeah, I think those are really great points. And Evans is, what, 6'6", 175 pounds, listed on the Duke website. We'll see when Combine comes around. I assume at worst he would declare for some feedback what that exactly looks like, if he's actually 175, it's a little more, if it's a little less. So that'll be very interesting. But the frame is right there for him to be able to add just some the appropriate amount of weight. Like you said, he's not going to make this incredible leap like Giannis and just be this incredibly jacked, just chiseled, just such a transformation physically. We're not really expect that. I always hear Mel Kiper talk about you don't want to bet on outliers and things like that. So you won't want to bet on him becoming like this outlier type of growth prospect. But at 6'7", the length, he does get effort. Kind of the consistency, you know, wanes a little bit, but that's with any young player, and especially a freshman in college and adjusting and trying to just really find your way. But the effort that he does give defensively, the contest with that length, like all that really goes a long way. And then just kind of speaking to some of what he's doing with kind of the wiry strength right now, if you will. But he had a really good possession in that UVA game on the road against Elijah Saunders, getting stopped in the paint. Elijah Saunders tried to body him from the free throw line down, and he was able to essentially wall him up, make him shoot over. And Elijah Saunders, 6'8", 240 pounds. Like, he has an NBA body right now. That is that guy, he's not taking any days off in the weight room. He's a serious physical specimen there. And Isaiah Evans got a stop on him and didn't back down. Even if he didn't get the stop on him, I just love his competitive nature there. And that's the type of things that you want to continue to see, no matter what position he's defending against, which is going to be a point guard, somebody bigger, somebody smaller. So that's what you want to see.
Yeah, it's a cliche for a reason that effort is so much of a part of defense. And, you know, effort waxing and waning from a freshman is not out of character by any stretch of the imagination. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the effort is there, right? Which I don't want to single anybody out because, honestly, A, I don't want to single anybody out. B, there's not a specific name that's coming to the top of my mind at the moment. But, like, you know, we all know that there are players who just don't put in the effort defensively at all. And so inconsistent effort is more, I think, something that can be taught, you know, something that players can grow with over time. Not giving the effort in the first place is a big red flag, and that's not something that's true with Evans. But I want to circle back to the off-ball offense, because given that you wrote about cutting in the piece, I wouldn't be me if I didn't at least bring it up as something that we needed to talk about. And I think it's a really important part of the package for Evans that he's such a high-level cutter, as you mentioned in the piece, because, you know, I don't know if you and I specifically have talked about it before, but I've certainly talked to death on this particular podcast of guys who are just pure spot-up shooters are starting to get phased out of the league. And so it's essentially, if you don't have the ball in your hands, what else are you doing to provide value to the team's offense? The easiest way to do that by far is as a cutter, especially as a wing, right? You're not expecting Isaiah Evans to set punishing screens anytime soon. So given that that's sort of out of the question, you know, the fact that he's someone who not only do defenses have to, you know, make sure the ball doesn't swing his way when he's beyond the 3-point line, but they also can't, you know, fall asleep and get caught ball watching, because he will make you pay if you do that. And that, I think, is really the most important secondary skill for someone who's a shooter of his level is, okay, you know, if I don't have the ball in my hands, am I just standing in the corner and hoping the ball swings my way? Or am I putting the defense in a situation where they have to make a tough decision? And so not only the, you know, sort of high IQ that he has in terms of understanding when he's supposed to cut, you know, the flashes of timing and savvy, as you mentioned in the piece, it's both that and sort of the willingness to do it. Again, it's similar to the sort of defensive side of things, where if you're putting in the effort, right? I mean, we talk about Steph Curry relocation all the time because it's the kind of thing where he just never stops running. Just purely that notion of never stopping running provides a whole lot of value as an off-ball shooter. And when you combine that with defenses actually have to pay attention to make sure you don't backdoor him, that creates a lot more opening for everybody else on the floor to succeed. And also, you know, for your own purposes, right? A defense can't just, you know, entirely play up on you at the 3-point line if they have to be worried about, oh, if I give him too much room, then I'm going to get backdoored and I'm going to look stupid.
Yeah, absolutely. Just that whole off-ball package, like, it just comes together beautifully when you just think about him, as we talk about him just as a shooter at the 99th percentile on spot-ups, shooting 51.9% on 52 spot-up attempts from three. When you already have that type of threat spotting up, and then you add that movement into it, and then what he's able to do as a movement shooter, you have to track him. He's able to fly around screens and stay square and rise and fire easily. And then working off of that, you know, it kind of just trickles down. That's when the cutting comes in, when you have to chase him around screens and you think he's going to go out to three, where he's going to flare it. He can curl it and he can set it up. You can set screens up and go back door, as you talked about. And if he doesn't get the ball there, it's back door. I'm running through the lanes. I'm relocating for three. So he's just has a lot of versatility, and I really want to continue to see him utilized that way. It'll probably be more next year than this year to kind of see him get utilized in more some go screens and just a little bit more versatility, some more on-ball juice with him as a shooter as well too. But for just for the off-ball stuff, all that translates right away and then just ties into what he does as that main skill, the main course of the shooting. And I think with any prospects, I'm thinking of maybe the connector skill. Maybe that's not maybe the, quite the word, but or maybe the building block skill, if you will. But essentially, maybe you have a great, I know you're a great wordsmith, but just trying to figure out something where shooting is kind of like that main building block for him. And then everything else kind of just trickles down, like we talk about with the off ball, the cutting. So with him having the shooting as that main thing and him having those supporting skills around it, I think he has a really good avenue to a high floor at the NBA level.
Yeah, I think, you know, really the thing with him, you know, is when you're talking about avenues to playing time, like what's your skill that's going to get you on an NBA floor, right? For Isaiah Evans, it's incredibly obvious. For some players, it's not quite as obvious, right? But the question then becomes, you know, again, sort of going back to what we were talking about earlier, okay, what else, right? And the cutting is big, but you know, you mentioned the 99th percentile spot up shooter, which is per synergy. There are a couple of other, I mean, obviously that stands out because it's hard to do much better than 99th percentile, yeah. But there are a couple other numbers that really stand out to me, which is in terms of shooting off screens, you know, he's not in the 99th percentile. He's still well above average. But the thing that stands out to me is that in terms of the percentage of his offensive looks that come off screens, that's where he ranks in the 99th percentile. And that to me says the story of, look, this is not just a spot up guy. This is someone who's generating chaos, who's making it difficult for defenses to figure out what to do. And, you know, you mentioned the sort of the flip side of that, which is, you know, for someone who's as good of a shooter as he is, he ranks in the 76th percentile in terms of efficacy on dribble jumpers and in the 8th percentile in terms of how often he takes them. And, you know, look, if you're, I mean, I lean on the Kings examples because they're always the easiest for me to lean on because they're the NBA team I watch the most. But Domantas Sabonis is not taking many jumpers off the dribble, right?
No.
You know, there are a lot of players who, you know, you don't want them to try and create looks for themselves off the dribble because that takes away from other incredibly successful areas of their game. With Evans, I mean, yeah, 98th percentile on jump shots, 95th percentile on catch and shoots, and 96th percentile when unguarded on those catch and shoots, right? That's a very strong floor, especially for a 6'6 player to have, as opposed to, yep, you know, like a 6'0 player, right? That's a very strong floor. And then the question becomes, okay, if you give him more responsibility, is there more there, or is this what he is, right? Is he, mm-hmm, an eighth man who's going to shoot 43% from 3-point range off the bench and play 15 minutes a game, and that's sort of his NBA career? That's a pretty good NBA career for anyone drafted outside of the top five. You know, when you look at success rate of draft picks, like sticking around in the NBA for a decade and shooting 43% from three, that's a strong pick. But with Evans, I think a whole lot of the question, and this, you know, very neatly transitions into the next section of the article, is the on-ball upside. Because that's, I think, where he goes from, this is a great complementary player, but clearly a complementary player, to maybe there's something more here. So I'm curious, mm-hmm, your thoughts on that, because certainly we haven't seen much of him having the ball in his hands this season. And as you mentioned, with Cam Boozer coming along, probably not likely that he'd have the ball in his hands much next year, but certainly more than this year. I'm curious sort of your thoughts on the on-ball upside, because that's, I think, where he can sort of change his profile from, this is a role player with a high floor, to this is someone who might be the third scorer on a good team.
Yeah, no doubt. The on-ball juice, that is most definitely the ceiling raiser for Isaiah Evans. As I mentioned in the piece, you really have to, if you believe in it, you really have to go back to the grassroots film, you know, the high school stuff and what he was doing and those moments there. And I do think there is a lot to like. There is some creativity with the bounce, loves the hesitation move. It's a decent first step. But I think just what he has as a comfortable ball handler and a tough shot maker, when he'll be able to get to the pull up. And I'm a little worried about him when he gets to the rim and finishing. You know, we talked a little bit about the frame. I believe he only has two dunks. Dunks isn't like the end all be all, obviously, as a measure of athleticism. But once he gets there, he's mostly below the rim, using that length around the rim as well, too. But it's all going to be tied to what he can do, whether it's going to be isolation or pick and rolls. And the hope is that he can have a increase in those type of roles and that type of, I guess more so, if he is going to be the number three, he should still be able to have at worst some of those pick and roll reps. And he's shooting, I think, about just over 5.6 attempts per game. You think that gets closer to 10 or so. So I think if he is able to get those increased reps next year, those shot attempts will come. And that should come in different situations and actions, and just not from playing off the ball.
Yeah, it's too small of a sample size to draw any real conclusions, but you know, it is nice to see that he ranks literally in the 100th percentile as a pick and roll ball handler, right? It's like, even though the sample size is too small to draw any definitive conclusions, it's a lot better to see that than the 0th percentile. The flip side of that is what you mentioned with the at rim scoring, and that's really the concern for me. He's shooting 55% at the rim. And, you know, look, there's more leeway for that kind of thing when you're mostly an off-ball guard than if you're expected to essentially be the head of the spear to generate looks not only for yourself but for others as well. You know, the at rim thing is the kind of thing where, look, if he's just making easy cuts, then yeah, sure, that's, you know, if that's his at rim diet, then that's perfectly fine in terms of him being a role player. If he's going to be more than a role player, he just needs to do better both at getting to the rim and at finishing around the basket. And that sort of leads me into my next question, which I'm curious, you've certainly reviewed more of the grassroots film of him recently than I have. What are your thoughts on sort of what he can do as a playmaker for others? Because certainly in terms of Duke this season, he's done a good job of not making mistakes. But I mean, you know, in terms of creating for others, there really isn't much there on the Duke film. Yeah. And part of that obviously is the role that he's asked to play, right? But it's not like he was such a superlative passer at the grassroots level that I'm willing to say, oh, okay, you know, this is just because he's playing in a limited role. And having an even assist to turnover ratio is fine for a big. It's more of a problem when you're a skinny wing, right? When it's like, okay, you really do need to at least make the easy reads. You know, and the question of creating for others is entirely level beyond, you know, making the easy passing reads. But I'm curious your thoughts on that, because especially given the package of the rest of his game, if he's going to be a, you know, top three option for an offense, let's just put it that way, I think the playmaking needs to get a lot better. And I'm curious if you are if you're optimistic on that front, or if it's more just that's something that he really needs to develop rather than something that he's had and not gotten a chance to show.
Yeah, it's certainly something that he still needs to develop. I think he's still has shown a little bit in college and definitely on the grassroots level that he can be a capable decision maker, someone that can make the easy reads, drive and kick. I've done my job. I've touched the paint. I've drawn the extra help, you know, I've drawn 2-3 sometimes on the grassroots level, and I've made the correct pass. So I think he can do that and shown his ability to do that. But it comes the next step, you know, as you were essentially talking about, where, all right, if you are that primary guy, are you reading the second and third level of the defense, especially out of pick and roll? Like, can you manipulate the defense? What type of playmaker can you really be for others, or can you pass others open? I'm not as optimistic right now. And it's like, these are things you really have to project moving forward when you don't have a good sample size, and they may not get a good of a sample size next year of it as well, too. So those are the things that I think is going to be very, very interesting to try to pick up on him as we close out the year. If he gets some more opportunities, or more so next year, as we talked about, it's going to be more of kind of that that big year for him if he does come back to show what are those ancillary skills, what can he do as a playmaker, you know, is there anything as a rebounder? Like, he's not doing much rebounding the ball either. So it's going to be very important with the increased role, what else he does outside of just scoring.
Yeah, and look, I mean, if you're good enough as a shooter, you can find a way, even without much passing talent or, you know, playmaking feel or any of that. I mean, Klay Thompson is going to be in the Hall of Fame one day, and, you know, one of the first thing that comes to mind when people think Klay Thompson is the 37-point quarter, and the second, you know, maybe this is just me as a Kings fan who watched that brutal moment for the other side of that particular exchange. Yeah, that was not as fun as it could have been. But, you know, the other thing that I think will be sort of the log line of Klay Thompson's career is the 60 points and 11 dribbles thing, right? And you can be a Hall of Famer without much of that playmaking feel, without contributing all that much on the glass, but you have to essentially be, you know, I would say Thompson is pretty clearly among the top five best shooters of all time, right? Like, that's the level that you need to reach if you don't have that kind of connective feel, if you're going to be more than a role player type, right? And you know, obviously Klay Thompson is well more than a role player type. Part of that also is the fact that he was an all defense caliber player earlier in his career. But, you know, just purely conceptually speaking, the odds of you being even a Buddy Hield in terms of, you know, how much you play, if you don't have that kind of passing feel, it's you've got to be something just superlative as a shooter to make that work without any passing feel. And with Evans, I think, you know, as you mentioned in the piece, and I would completely agree, there's a lot of sort of on-ball stuff that he can do for himself, that his shooting touch and his handle is more than good enough to create for himself. That's, again, just where I'm worried about it is, and I'm less worried about it because he's as good of a cutter as he is, but essentially the same question of, look, what do you do when you don't have the ball in your hands? And when you do have the ball in your hands, are you someone who can make a defense pay for giving you space, whether that be space beyond the three-point line or space to an open passer in the corner who you can swing to, or space to cut behind a guy and get an easy backdoor cut to the basket, right? It's just a whole lot of it is what can you do when you're not the focus, and also what can you do for other people when you are the focus? And I'm much more optimistic about what he can do with the ball in his hands for himself than I am about the playmaking element. But, you know, again, the idea there is really just what does, you know, and you and I have talked about this before, what does the 95th percentile look like? The 95th percentile outcome is he gets a little bit better as a passer, a lot better as an on-ball creator, and he can be a second or third scorer for a really good team. There just needs to be a bit more passing feel. And as you've already mentioned, we just don't have much evidence of that in a way that, who knows, maybe he comes back next year and we see a whole lot of that. Maybe he goes to the NBA. He's just, you know, out of thin air. He's the 27th pick and he plays 10 minutes a game and all he does is shoot, you know, okay. He can figure that out in the longer term at the NBA level, but there isn't as much evidence of that as there is for the next point, which we're going to talk about, which is the defense. And we've touched on it, you know, here and there throughout the episode today, but that I think is really going to be the swing of, there have been a lot of NBA players who are exceptional shooters who just can't keep up defensively at a high enough level to stick it out there on the floor. And, you know, pretty much all rookies are bad defensively. I'm not worried about it from that standpoint, but you know, I think by year three, if we haven't seen flashes from Evans defensively, then I start getting concerned. But as you've mentioned in the piece, there have been flashes already this season. And even if it's inconsistent, the effort is there, which is a huge part of the baseline for, can you at least be part of a defensive scheme? I'm much more confident in him being able to be a part of a defensive scheme than I am of him being even a basic baseline level connective passer. I'm curious your thoughts there, because certainly even if he doesn't figure out the passing stuff, if he becomes a better defender, then, you know, 3 and D guys are all the rage for a reason, right? That could be something where he could figure out more of that kind of stuff. But certainly in terms of the 95th percentile outcome, I think that's a lot more dependent on him growing as a passer, growing as an on-ball guy. If we're talking about like the 65th percentile outcome, then I think that's really just he continues to get better about his defensive effort and he puts on a little bit of weight, which is, again, the 65th percentile outcome, because that's a lot easier for me to envision than him becoming a much, much better playmaker without anywhere near as much evidence of that as there is of defensive potential, at least in my eyes.
Exactly. Like him reaching that 65th percentile outcome is much more obtainable, especially when that is really associated with him defensively. And we've seen him do already some really solid things and have made improvements throughout the year and even from high school as well. Him having that size and that length and just the effort that he's given both on and off the ball, which is incredibly important. And then being able to defend within that team construct. And he's on Duke. I'm not sure where they are right now, but I think they're still in the top five, but they are in that top tier of defensive teams in the country. And when he's on there, obviously he's not an anchor or anything, but like he's contributing with his effort, with his competitive nature, you know, with the intensity that he does show when he's out there. My hope is that he will take a step up as a defensive playmaker, because with his length and some of the athleticism, like there is some low-hanging fruit for him there. He's averaging 0.2 stocks per game right now, and
not great.
That is not great at all, certainly not ideal. You know, so if he can take that up, even to get to one, you know, just kind of take that next step and just showing some more disruptiveness, you know, with his activity, I would love to see that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky because those defensive playmaking stats, steals in particular, the translation, and this is out of date because I've been using this exact number for like 7 years at this point, so it's probably, it's almost certainly not exactly correct anymore, but I think conceptually it's about the same of the translation of steals rates from non-NBA levels to NBA levels is about 90%. Essentially, if you get a lot of steals at the college level, you're going to get a lot of steals at the NBA level. And, you know, the exceptions to that rule almost, it's really funny. The exceptions to that rule are split essentially half and half between guys who really turned a corner defensively at the NBA level and Syracuse players who got a whole lot of blocks and steals that they didn't get once they were in a different system, right? So that's the kind of thing where, you know, it would be great if he can add that sort of defensive playmaking element. It's not out of the question. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm more sort of in the camp of, you know, for a lot of players who don't sort of naturally have that feel for getting into passing lanes, a lot of times the only way those guys improve their steals numbers is just gambling a lot more. And that's not something that I would necessarily want from him. So I'm kind of torn in the sense that I think really just getting better as, you know, just getting better with the consistency, getting, you know, putting on strength is obviously the biggest thing. But for me, if I'm sort of projecting Evans out, I'm more looking at it as, can he get to a point where he's comfortably average as part of a defensive scheme, right? Not someone who necessarily is making a ton of gambles. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where there are some players who really do figure that out. Like, you know, just speaking of Duke in particular, right? Kyle Filipowski was not a defensive playmaker year one, and he turned into that year two. It's not unheard of, but I think a much more likely path for Evans is just get to a point where he's a comfortably average part of a defensive scheme. So he's not getting played off the floor for his defense more than, I think that's a much more likely outcome than, okay, he reaches this point where he really figures it out as a defensive playmaker, because of all the things that players tend to figure out between lower levels and the NBA, defensive playmaking tends to be the stickiest in terms of you have to really overhaul your game to go from a non-factor in that regard to an impact player. So if I were Evans, I would be more focused on just, you know, getting better as an on-ball guy, putting on a little bit of weight, getting more consistent with the defensive effort. And who knows, maybe he does figure out that defensive playmaking stuff, but I'm more willing to bet on almost anything else in general for a prospect. And I think for Evans in particular, I'm more willing to buy into everything else getting figured out rather than the defensive playmaking, because it does happen, but it's a lot more rare than guys figuring out how to shoot, for example.
Yeah, and then I think just something to think about, if he does come back, the minutes are increased, the roles increase, the offensive load increase, does that affect his defense? You know, so many times throughout the course of basketball history, you know, we know how it is when you're handling the offensive load, unless you're BJ Edgecombe, I guess, right now. Like that defensive end, you know, it drops a little bit, and that's understandable. So for someone who continues needs to improve the defense, does that take a step back while the offense kind of goes back to his accustomed levels in that role? So that'll be very interesting to watch.
Yeah, that's a very good point. He doesn't have that excuse in a way that a lot of other, you know, college players do of, oh, well, I have all this offensive responsibility, and you're also asking me to be like the best defender on the team. That's not the case for Evans. And so, you know, again, it's the kind of thing where if there was no defensive effort, I'd be a lot more concerned. But it's also the kind of thing where there isn't that sort of built-in excuse like there would be for, say, VJ Edgecombe, as you mentioned, or even a slightly lower caliber, but in my mind, still very good defender in Dylan Harper of all this, you know, just people struggle to do this in a way that, you know, upsets me on a human level. But, you know, these are human beings out there, right? Like,
yeah.
If you can't run for 45 consecutive minutes, you shouldn't expect, you know, some of the top tier athletes in the entire world to be able to do that, right? And so, you know, just think about it from the most basic human level of, hey, if I'm running a lot on one end of the floor, you know, maybe I'm getting back slower in transition because I'm gassed, right? It's just the human element of things that, you know, there's sort of the GMification and also the 2Kification of, oh, well, you know, in my 2K save, I can play in 48 consecutive minutes. It's like, that's not how, unless you're Wilt Chamberlain 50 years ago, that's not how it works.
It certainly doesn't.
So, you know, again, it's the kind of thing where I think the tools are there defensively. I think, you know, he's not, as you mentioned, he's not the most ridiculous athlete, but I think he's good enough. And as you mentioned in the Outlook section, as we sort of get to wrapping up here, I'm just going to quote you directly because you said it a lot better and a lot more succinctly than I'm going to be able to off the top of my head. His NBA role floor is nearly identical to his current one at Duke, a floor spacing wing, an outstanding movement shooter that can attack closeouts. And that's, I think, you know, a whole lot of what we've been talking about, right? Of the players who are, you know, consensus not in the first round right now, Isaiah Evans has one of the higher floors because just look at the shooting, right? It's like every NBA team needs that. He provides that at a ridiculously high level. And, you know, for all the concerns we've mentioned about the frame, you know, if he were 6-0, then there would be fewer avenues to playing time as there are for him being 6'6". There's much more reason to be hopeful about the defense going forward. There are more players that he can shoot over than if he were 6-even, right? There's a whole lot of the baseline stuff with Isaiah Evans that is very, very promising. And, you know, if he declares this year because he gets a first round promise, I would not be surprised if he goes back next season and becomes a lottery pick. Like, hey, the guy we started out the podcast with, Jordan Hawkins, I would also not be surprised. But, you know, again, when we're talking about the second round of this draft, and we've talked internally on the No Ceiling side of, you know, some of the people on the No Ceiling side are struggling with, you know, who's going to be a second round pick. Like, who do we like after the top 20 or so? And of all those players in that sort of range, I think I'm a bit more optimistic about this year's second round than many, but just generally speaking, once you get outside of that top 20, there aren't many players that have as high of a floor. I mean, the one that stands out to me just because I wrote about him this year is Ryan Kalkbrenner of like, look, the ceiling might not be all that high, but, you know, a floor of a 7-footer who's historically efficient offensively and blocks 2 shots a game defensively, you know, most NBA teams can find minutes for that kind of guy. And Evans is, you know, on the one hand, almost Calcred is diametrical opposite in terms of how much their team relies on them. But the flip side of that is, you know, look, 6'6 guys who can shoot and can at least make defenses hurt when they're sort of forced off the line. It's a very easy archetype. And there are a lot of teams that, you know, every team needs multiple of those kind of players, right? It's not just every team wants one of these guys. Every team wants multiple of these kind of guys. So as long as the defense is decent, I think Isaiah Evans is going to have quite a long NBA career. And then the question, you know, as we mentioned, whether he goes back or not, is just how much can he sort of raise the ceiling on what people think about him with the ball in his hands? Because, again, the floor is very, very, very high.
Yeah, and all teams, like you said, need multiple guys like that and with that size that can shoot the ball with the ball skills and everything and have that type of floor. Before we do kind of wrap up and get out of here, I do have one question for you. Why don't you think Evans kind of is not getting the same amount of love or just comparable amount of love to other shooters like Khan and like Liam McNeely, who are considered the top tier shooters in this class? Is it a volume type of thing, or plays it tied back to the playing time, or just simply not good of a shooter as they are? Because the numbers are saying he's right there.
I think it's a volume thing. I mean, it, for me personally, it's a volume thing of just, you know, in terms of the number of shots that they get up specifically from 3-point range, it's not all that different. But for both Khan and Liam McNeely, they've shown a bit more success inside the arc. I think Khan is a very interesting comparison for multiple reasons, because the sort of defensive hope that I have with Isaiah Evans, it's harder for me to see a world where Khan is even an average defender. The flip side of that is Khan is so much better as a playmaker that's sort of what draws the line for me of like, look, you know, if you're throwing Khan into an offensive context, he's going to be a connective passer right away in a way that's sort of what we're hoping to see from Isaiah Evans. And with Liam McNeely, you know, I think he's more advanced defensively at this point in his development than Isaiah Evans and way ahead of Khan. But, you know, if I had to sort of parse it out that way, McNeely might purely in terms of shooting be the weakest of the three, but the ancillary skills are much higher for him than they are for Isaiah Evans. And even for Khan, because, you know, they're both very good. McNeely and Khan are both very good playmakers. I buy into McNeely as a defender in a way that I don't with Khan and in a way that I don't with Isaiah Evans. So I think it's very fair when you're looking at it, just pure shooters. I think Isaiah has an argument for the best pure shooter. He's either the best or the second best pure shooter. It's the everything else with those two other guys. That's more just positives about their game than it is, hey, why is Isaiah Evans not in that level? Cause I think he is as purely a shooter. It's just, again, the other elements of ways that players can earn their way into a rotation that I'm just more comfortable with for both of those other guys.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I completely agree. And you talk about like Khan and both McNeely as well. Well, I guess with McNeely kind of has a combination of them both, but as far as defensively, McNeely can kind of rely upon, although still not the greatest defender, a combination of both strength and, you know, height or size. And more for us all, for Khan, it's that strength. For Isaiah Evans, that length and the size that he has to rely upon defensively. Yeah, so I'm just very interested to see where all of them end up on boards. But ultimately, when you kind of factor in the totality of their work, I completely agree why Isaiah Evans will be behind those guys.
The flip side, though, as you mentioned, is he's getting more playing time at the right moment in the season, right? And it's the kind of thing where, especially given where he was projected earlier in the season, you know, the good things that he has done out there on the floor and the profile of every Duke team, but this Duke team in particular, I mean, a good tournament run for Isaiah Evans and he could very easily be a top 20 pick. And that's, I think, you know, as you mentioned earlier, maybe that's where you draw the line of do I stay or do I go? A really hot March Madness run from Isaiah Evans could make it a very clear, yeah, I'm going to declare. We're good here.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you fall in love with, like, I think it's just like the infectious energy that he brings when he's hitting shots and he giving you the three mask. And then when he's even on the bench and he's not playing, when he hasn't been playing, was something that I give him a huge credit to being able to be a good teammate when the minutes were spotty. He wasn't playing a lot. He's on the bench. He's still celebrating for the team, his teammates. He's very happy for them and excited for them. So those are the type of things you want to see teammate-wise, and when things aren't exactly going your way and you don't know what's going to happen next, what they're doing, and that type of character stuff you see. So I think that's going to be very important for scouts to really see and continue to see. And I think will also carry over once he gets to interviews and get a chance to talk to teams as well.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. It's again, going back to what we talked about earlier, it's the human element, right? Like, who do you want to be in a locker room with? Do you want to be in the locker room with the guy who's cheering for you, even if it's at the expense of his own playing time? Or do you want to you want to be in the locker room with the guy who's pouting because he only got 25 minutes instead of 30, right? It's, you know, just on the most basic human level, it's a pretty easy answer. And you want the guys who are going to make everybody else feel better about how things are going. And it's not just the energy, but, you know, also just the support of, hey, maybe I'm not getting the most minutes, right? I mean, you know, not to be unkind, but the reason that DeAndre Jordan is still in the NBA is because people like him and they like having him in the locker room, right? So even long after his ridiculous athletic gifts declined, he's still getting NBA deals because teams still want to have him around.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I've heard so many times just from different NBA executives, it's like, all right, so who can I lose with? Like, winning's easy. Like, once you're winning, like, everyone's excited and everyone's happy. Like, it's great. It's utopia. Like, it's incredible. But when you are fighting adversity, when you've lost 8, 9, 10 straight games, you've lost 10 out of 13, you lost every game on the road trip, and you're just going through some tough stretches and tough seasons, quite frankly, you know, what type of people can you lose within that locker room that are going to turn it around? They aren't happy with losing, but they aren't going to be this type of destructive force with losing, but they aren't going to be happy about it. They're going to look to turn it around and kind of show that competitive character.
That's a perfect way of putting it. Who can you lose with? Yeah, I mean, you know, back in a previous life, I was a semi, I guess, technically professional touring musician. And it's like, at a certain point, it's like, if you're on a two week tour, you know, unless someone is like the worst kind of person possible, you know, you'll be fine for 2 weeks, right? NBA seasons are months long. And by the time you get to month two of any sort of, you know, close knit sort of, I mean, the groups that I was in were, you know, in the teens in terms of number of people. So pretty similar to an NBA roster, right? Of like, okay, at a certain point, if there's one person who's just exhausting to be around, it almost doesn't matter how good they are. And that's something that you can apply to a whole wide variety of things in life. But particularly when you're on the road with these other human beings for months of the year, yeah, it's, you know, who you want to play cards with on the plane and who can you lose with, rather than, you know, this guy's great when things are going well, but for a lot of, you know, especially for a lot of the top tier rookies, they're not going to good teams. And so being able to be a decent person to be around when things aren't going great is very underrated. And, you know, it goes back to just, these are human beings and some people get along and some people don't. And if you're easier to get along with, then your locker room is going to be a lot happier place than if you're not.
Yeah. Really novel concept, right? We're dropping some, some life skills, some gems here.
Yeah. Shout out to the Phoenix Suns. That was unnecessary. Anything else you want to cover before we wrap this one up?
No, my always a pleasure being able to hop on here and dive into different prospects, and we branch out a little different ways with different philosophy talks and things that come up. So always love it and appreciate it.
Well, thank you for the compliment. I'm not good at dealing with those, but I thank you for it anyway. And thank you, of course, for joining us for today's episode. You can find Jam on Twitter at Jam on the Boards, and you can, of course, find his written work over at NoCeilingsNBA.com. You can find me on Blue Sky at NBA Johnson, and you can find my written work on NoCeilingsNBA.com. If you've been enjoying the show, please take the time to leave a rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you might be using. That is always much appreciated on our end. And if you have any feedback regarding the deep dive specific portion of the podcast, feel free to reach out to me either Blue Sky or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.